From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the fourth day of May 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana. And Harry Cooney of Growmark will join us to take up the energy markets. We'll also hear today from the statisticians in Iowa, Illinois, Nebraska, Minnesota, and Indiana. Those are the top five corn-producing states in the nation in order from top to bottom. They'll tell us about growing conditions and planting progress. In the second half hour of the program today on many of these stations and always online at willag.org, we'll explore how the federal government is using the National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado to take some risk out of the developing renewable fuels technology industry. And in just 26 minutes, meteorologist Don Day will join us to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
In Chicago, on this Tuesday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. The nearby May wheat at 4.99¾. A settlement price today, up 9¾. July at 5.10¾, 9 cents higher. September at 5.26½, up 8¾. All for the soft red. Hard red, July contract, Kansas City, 5.22½, up 9½ cents. Back in Chicago for the corn pit, $3.60. The lead option May settled 2¾ lower. July corn at 3.69, settlement price down 2½. September 3.77¾, down 2½. And December futures 3.87, down 2½ cents. March contract 3.99¾, down 2 on the afternoon. May soybean futures $9.77, up a penny and a quarter. July at 9.87, up a half. And then we start the losses. August contract 9.84¾, down 3/4. September at 9.70, 2½ cents lower. And November soybeans, the new crop at 9.63 settlement price, down 3½ cents. May bean meal futures 285.50, up $2.80. July 287.80, up 2.80 as well. May soybean oil down 29 cents at 38.36. July at 38.68, down 33. June live cattle futures $96.25, up 50 cents. August a 20 cent gain at $95.15. May feeder cattle 113.42½, up 2½ cents. The August though down a nickel at $116.60. And the May lean hog futures $90.25, up 20 cents. June down 17½ at $86.75 on the afternoon. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is a production of Illinois Public Media. It comes to you from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures, June contract, $82.80 a barrel, down $3.39 in the June. May futures for the ethanol at $1.59¾, 0.2 cents higher. Natural gas at $4.04, up 1¼ cents. And the June heating oil or diesel fuel, down 8¼ cents at $2.26. Gold futures, a settlement price at $1,168.60, down $14.10 in the Dow at 10,901, now down 250 points on the afternoon. The Goldman Sachs down 17.23 at 535.81. Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like. It says windy and warmer conditions over the next 2 days will help to advance the planting across the area before the next system of rain falls on Thursday and Friday. Isolated, scattered thunderstorms will develop Wednesday afternoon with a main focus on northern and central Indiana, although a few eastern Illinois locations could pick up some rain as well. The impact of the storms will be very, very localized. A cold front arriving late this work week will bring heavier precip to the northern sections of Illinois and Indiana, resulting in more delays. Some northern Indiana locations could get as much as 2 inches of rain, resulting in localized flooding. Unseasonably cold temperatures then will follow the rains later this week, and there will be a potential for some freezing or near-freezing temperatures in northern sections and historically colder central locations over the weekend. We'll have a more complete look at the weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour, and we talk with Don Day of Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
This is the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. On a Tuesday afternoon, time to check in with the agricultural futures markets. Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of Newmarket, Indiana, is on the phone line today. Good afternoon to you, Wayne.
Boy, good afternoon, Todd.
Kind of interesting. I think I want to start with the outside markets. When I got down to the Dow Jones Industrial Average and I saw that it had been down some 250 points today, it surprised me. What's happening there?
Well, of course, the outside markets, when we say the outside markets, meaning the European or foreign markets, in the overnight, as we started out the morning, as we listened to the early news, we heard they were down overnight. Of course, the euro dollar, of course, continuing to take a hit. I think it's at 11.5-month lows compared to the dollar here because of that, and a little bit of just uncertainty as to how the world economy is going to react and whether the bailout for Greece and Portugal and Spain and how everything is going along on that and how smoothly it'll run. So that pulled the stock market on down to help the dollar rally, the dollar being up 99 right now or just about a full point. And then crude oil, because of that same instance, down $3.40 as we're speaking here right now. And that precluded a much lower opening in the grains because of all the outside markets and, of course, our planting progress being way ahead of normal for this time of year, Todd. But they couldn't seem to hold them down there for the day, could they?
Yeah, they couldn't hold them down. Is that because there's a flight of money on at least this day looking for safe havens like the dollar and possibly grains and oil seeds?
Well, I think that has a lot to do with it. You had your fund buying. Well, yesterday was May Day or a holiday from First of May or May Day in Europe, and the money that flows into the market didn't flow until today, basically because of that. At these lower levels and finding some support levels, why we found the funds willing to enter some of the markets. And some of the sharp sell-offs this morning were met with some profit-taking late in the days by some of the day traders, but we're just a little bit amazed that they were able to sustain this market as much as they were with the outside markets down as hard as they are. And, you know, with crude down this hard, you know, it wouldn't be surprising to see it rebound a little bit tomorrow off these kind of losses.
Yeah, will crude go down, do you think, continue or stay steady, or will it be, and I guess I'm talking in ratio, or will corn drop in concert with crude in its overnight trade?
You know, I think that, you know, we saw sort of the rebound in the corn. I think we'll probably, you know, nurture the losses in the crude oil a little bit along the way as we finish up the day. Now, we do have the EIA reports tomorrow, and they are looking for some pretty hefty gains as far as inventory because the import level that we had trying to gear up for the summer driving. And our usage actually was up about 3% as far as the unleaded gasoline over the last 30 days. So we are trying to gear up for the summer driving period, Todd, and that's one of the reasons we might see a little strength come back into the crude.
So a little strength in the crude, and will that give some help out to the grains?
I would think that, you know, but I think we're in a sideways trading range here now, looking to see whether the weather will stay cold and damp and prohibit planting progress from advancing much. So, I mean, that's a little bit of the thing we're looking at, too. I don't see anything in the weather so bad. You know, we can sit back a couple weeks and still not be behind our normal pace. But, you know, there's a lot to finish up as far as planting and the corn and the beans both. But, you know, we can be out of the field a few days and still not be falling behind here.
This is the time of the year when farmers are generally busy and they stand aside from the market because of that. Is it okay, do you think, at this point? Is that the right thing to do with the volatility that's in the marketplace?
Well, I think that basically, you know, if we could get some good rallies, you know, corn back above $4 or beans up 20 cents here or something, well, then I think they ought to be doing a little selling. But otherwise, right in here, why, as the farmer holds off selling, why, it does help strengthen the market, and that's to his advantage to come back in.
All right. Thank you so much. We appreciate you being with us for the day.
Thank you, Todd.
Wayne Nelson is with L&M Commodities. He's out of Newmarket, Indiana. Joins us here on the Closing Mark Report. That happens each and every Tuesday afternoon. You can listen to him again if you'd like from your phone. Dial this number, 217-333-3434. We call it our mobile analyst portal. The number is 217-333-3434. It's posted with an update just after the opens and just after the closes, a bit of analysis and some numbers at those times at 10:15 and 3:15 daily. Again, the mobile analyst portal, it's at 217-333-3434.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Tim Wells in Moline at 309-797-7369. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
This is the Closing Mark Report from the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Well, nationally yesterday, USDA reported that 68% of the corn crop had been planted by last week's end, 36 percentage points ahead of last year, 28 percentage points ahead of the five-year average. USDA says producers throughout much of the major corn-producing area of the nation planted very rapidly. While fieldwork was in full swing under favorable conditions, the most progress was evident in the Great Lakes region. Nebraska and Pennsylvania, where 20% or more of their crop was planted during the week, were the big jump. Overall, emergence advanced 12 percentage points during the week at 19% complete. Emergence was 15 percentage points ahead of last year, 10 points ahead of the rolling five-year average. Warm, sunny conditions in areas of the Corn Belt promoted rapid emergence during the week. Soybeans by May 2nd, well, producers had planted 15% of the nation's bean crop, 10 percentage points ahead of last year, 7 points ahead of the five-year rolling average. Planting most advanced, of course, in the Delta region, where 33% of that crop was in the ground by the week's end. Now, here are the state statisticians from the five top corn-producing states in the nation.
This is Greg Tayson, director of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service Iowa Field Office, with the weekly crops and weather report for the week ending May 2nd, 2010. Heavy rain and strong winds limited field work during the week and slowed planting compared with the blistering pace set the prior week. In areas where the heaviest rain fell, reports indicate problems with soil erosion, standing water in low-lying fields, and a concern some replanting may be needed due to crusting of the soil. A few areas even received light hail, but little to no damage was reported. Even with the severe weather, farmers continued to plant crops when the weather permitted. Corn planting advanced 84% complete, increasing 16 percentage points from last week, but much slower than the prior week's pace when producers planted 49% of their acreage. Corn planting progress is 10 days ahead of last year, 13 days ahead of the five-year average, and still the furthest along for the first week of May in recorded history. Corn acreage emerge was 19%, well ahead of the 2% last year and the five-year average of 4%. Producers have planted 13% of their soybean acreage compared with 5% for both last year and the five-year average. This is Greg Tayson reporting from the USDA NAS Iowa Field Office.
This is Brad Schwab, Chief Crop Statistician with the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Illinois Field Office, reporting on crop progress and conditions for the week ending May 2nd. Farmers across much of Illinois were enjoying excellent weather conditions last week, with corn planting nearing completion, which allowed many farmers to move on to soybean planting. The wettest area of the state was in the southeastern crop reporting district, where they received a total of 2.27 inches for the seven-day period ending May 2nd. And considering the above-normal precipitation, it should be no surprise that the week ended with only 2.9 days suitable for field work. Statewide corn planting advanced by another 14 percentage points from last week and is currently at 87% planted. This is well ahead of last year's 5% and the five-year average of 47%. The area leading the state in planting progress was the Eastern Crop Reporting District at 96%, while the Southeastern Crop Reporting District trailed all others at 71%. Emergence advanced to 39% compared to 0% emerged last year and 15% for the five-year average. Soybean planting is now well underway at 11% complete, and this compares to 0% planted last year and 4% for the five-year average. The Northwestern Crop Reporting District leads the state with 22% of their soybeans in the ground. 12% of the soft red winter wheat crop was reported headed by week's end, and this compares to 5% last year and 16% for the five-year average. This has been Brad Schwab with the Illinois Field Office of the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service in Springfield.
This is David Biar of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service with the crop weather report for the week ending May 2, 2010. Temperatures averaged 4 degrees below normal for the week, with below freezing temperatures recorded in the western half of the state. Highs range from the low 70s to upper 80s. Precipitation fell throughout the state with heaviest accumulation of over 1.5 inches in the southeast district. Producers made progress and have 48% of the corn crop planted, the same as last year and ahead of the 37 average. Corn is starting to emerge. Soybean planting was 8% complete, ahead of last year's 6 and the 4 average. Sorghum planting was just underway at 1% complete, behind last year. Wheat conditions rated 2% poor, 24 fair, 66 good, 8 excellent, above the 71% good or excellent last year. Wheat jointed is 30%. Alfalfa pasture and range conditions were mostly good or excellent and well above last year. This is David Biar of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Nebraska Field Office in Lincoln.
This is Kathy King, Agricultural Statistician with the USDA NAS Minnesota Field Office, with a crop weather report for the week ending May 2, 2010. Dry, mild weather early in the week allowed producers to continue planting at an above-average pace. Showers delivered moderate precipitation statewide Thursday night into Friday, and scattered showers continued throughout the weekend. Precipitation amounts varied, with the north-central region receiving an average of 1 inch and the south-central region receiving an average of a quarter inch. April 2010 was the second warmest April dating back to 1891, and overall producers reported being pleased with spring planting progression. Spring wheat planting advanced to 98% complete, compared to 16% planted last year and 34% for the five-year average. 67% of the crop has emerged, and 94% of the crop was rated in good to excellent condition. Corn planting advanced to 87% complete, 31 percentage points ahead of last year and 46 points ahead of average. Soybean planting was 19% complete, compared to 6% last year and 4% average. This has been Kathy King of the USDA NAS Minnesota Field Office with a crop weather report for the week ending May 2, 2010.
Hello, this is Greg Preston, Director of the USDA NAS Field Office for Indiana, and this is the crop weather report for the week ending May 2nd. The record pace for corn planting continued until the rainy, windy weather slowed field work. The previous record for corn planting was set in 2004, when 70% of the corn was planted at that time. Soybean planting fell slightly behind the record pace set in 2001, when 28% was in the ground at this time. Windy conditions limited herbicide application, and some flooding was reported in low-lying areas in southern Indiana. 71% of the intended corn acreage has been planted, well ahead of last year's 5% planted at this time and the five-year average of 30%. By area of the state, 70% has been planted in the north, 76% in the central region, and 62% in central Indiana. 26% of the planted corn acreage has emerged, up 21 points from last week and well ahead of 0% recorded for last year and 5% for the five-year average. 21% of the intended soybean acreage has been planted, compared to 0% for last year and 6% for the five-year average. 69% of the winter wheat acreage is jointed, compared with 60% for last year and 71% for the five-year average. Winter wheat condition improved from last week and is rated at 72% good to excellent, compared to 79% last year at this time. This is Greg Preston reporting from the Indiana NAS Field Office.
And I'm Todd Gleason at the Urbana-Champaign Campus Studios of Illinois Public Media. This afternoon on the line with us to take a look at the agricultural energy markets as he is once a month, Harry Cooney from Growmark in Bloomington, Illinois. What a day it's been, Harry.
Boy, that's right, Todd. It's been kind of a real roller coaster, but mostly on the downside here in the energy markets. And we've been following the stock market down today. Right now, the stock market is quite a bit lower, down about 225 points. And the dollar is rallying sharply here today. The dollar is up over 100 points at the present time. And both those items, the rally in the dollar and the incredible weakness here in the stock market, has definitely given our oil markets a drag. We closed crude oil down about $3.45 today.
Yeah, so crude oil gets more expensive, right, as the dollar rises in price?
Is that... as the dollar rises, crude oil tends to come down.
Right, so, it comes down because it would be more expensive here.
Yes, that's exactly right. And we had some of the outside markets falling also, where the grains were down, the metals were down. When you look at crude oil, though, we've been in a range from about 80 or 82 on the bottom, up to about 87 on the top. Yesterday, for example, we rallied up to about that 87 on the top. So today we're coming down. We're ending somewhere in the $82 to $83 range on the close here. So we're still well within this recent trading range. And so now we'll have to see in the next few days if this action in the dollar and the stock market continue to pull the energies down or not.
Any good reported reasons, good being the key word, that you saw for the move in the dollar and the stock market?
Well, we continue to hear talk out of the European countries, you know, like Greece, for example, that's having some problems economically over there. And as their currency falls, as the euros falls and such over there, our dollar tends to rally. So it may not be that analysts and traders are wanting to buy the dollar because they're real bullish on it, as much as they're bearish on these other currencies. And when they go down, our dollar goes up. Of course, in the background, I think there's talk of interest rates eventually trying to move up. If interest rates do move up, that would be supportive for our dollar. The oil spill in the Gulf, of course, has been the big news. We had a lot of member companies, our FS member companies, calling today with end users coming in and with the talk of $4 fuel out there. And we just don't think that that's in the cards from this oil spill down there. The oil spill really isn't affecting demand much. As far as supply, it's taking the one well out of commission, of course, but that's just a drop in the bucket, really. It's a major environmental situation. But as far as supply and demand for the oil markets, it's really not affecting them much. We do always have to watch if that oil slick would move over around the large offshore oil platform located about 20 miles south of Grand Isle, Louisiana. That's where these big ships come across the ocean and unload their oil. If for some reason that would get shut because of the oil spill, then we could have more of a bullish impact in the oil markets. But until that happens, or unless that happens, probably we're going to be dealing with more of these other factors like the dollar and the stock market.
Just about a minute left. The last time we talked with you a month ago, you were still thinking that this was the time for the marketplace to rally. I suppose technically, has that begun to turn the corner yet?
No. I think this is still just a consolidation. It may be more of a setback in here, but I don't think that the overall rally of the oil markets is most likely over. We'll just have to see how deep the stock market weakness gets. However, if it would go down more than I think, then we just look at it as an opportunity to start contracting fall diesel for end users.
All right. Thanks so much, Harry.
Thank you, Todd.
Harry Cooney is with GrowMark in Bloomington, Illinois. Joins us once a month on a Tuesday to talk about the agricultural energy markets. Don Day of Day Weather will be here shortly to take up the agricultural weather market. And we'll talk with him in just about 2 minutes. You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, Senate Majority Whip Richard Durbin says debate on the bill to regulate Wall Street could consume the bulk of Senate floor time during the weeks leading up to the Memorial Day recess. Speaking yesterday with reporters, Durbin said consideration of the financial regulatory reform bill could take virtually the entire month of May. At a minimum, he said, quote, it will take 2 weeks. Farm Credit System, the U.S. government-sponsored lender to rural and farm customers, said it posted a first-quarter net income of $802 million, up 30.4% on the same quarter a year ago. Net interest income was $1.414 billion in the 3 months ending March 31st, as compared with $1.273 billion a year earlier. FCS holds more than a third of U.S. farm debt. U.S. representatives for wheat, corn, beef, and other farm commodity producers are banding together to demand that Congress ratify trade agreements that U.S. negotiators struck with South Korea, Colombia, and Panama years ago. Colombia is especially important for U.S. wheat, according to the U.S. Wheat Associates. Meanwhile, U.S. beef producers are pushing Congress to ratify the U.S.-South Korea FTA. And U.S. agricultural processor Archer Daniels Midland today says it posted higher earnings of $421 million, or 65 cents a share. And that's a look at today's business news.
Listening to the Closing Mark Report. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. On a Tuesday afternoon, we're joined by Don Day of Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. Good afternoon to you, Don.
Good afternoon.
Tell me about the weather first here in the Midwest. Looks like we'll have another rainstorm eventually.
Yeah, we will. We've got a pattern I see at least for the next 10 or 14 days here that's going to be occasionally wet, as we're going to see several systems come through the nation, much like what we've seen over the last two weekends. The next system is going to be coming out of the high plains, and it will bring, at first, some pretty good moisture to some areas that need it, like North and South Dakota, portions of western Minnesota, which haven't gotten a lot of moisture lately, or we'll see that moisture increase. And this system will spread some shower and thunderstorm activity later this week and into the start of the weekend into the Midwest and Corn Belt. Coverage should be pretty good again, favoring the northern and western areas. We're hoping there's not as much rain in the southern areas where we saw the flooding over the weekend, but it's something we'll need to watch.
Yeah, there was wet in those southern areas, especially in Tennessee. How much rainfall do you think this system will bring?
Well, I think when you look at Iowa, when you look at northern Illinois, Wisconsin, eastern Nebraska, and some portions of northern Missouri, those areas could be looking at anywhere from, well, 1.5 to 3 inches of rain. Wouldn't be surprised if we see that much. Elsewhere, across central Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, into central Missouri, I think we're looking at probably 1.5 inches of rain.
Other places around the globe you're watching, I think that we're mostly interested because they're looking at importing some corn at China and what their growing conditions are for the start of their season.
Well, it's been a little bit dry over there, but it's picking up in terms of chances for precipitation. Precipitation is a good bet. Now, will it be widespread getting most areas? Well, I'd say coverage of China's growing areas will see about 60 to 70% coverage of rainfall, more than they've seen in a while. So they'll get a little bit of a benefit from some spring rains there.
And maybe better check in on the wheat crop, which is progressing in Ukraine and in India and in the northern hemisphere in particular.
Well, there's going to be good precipitation chances in the Ukraine. All of Europe is looking at good chances for some cool, wet weather there. So there's going to be some rainfall and probably some cooler than normal temperatures to go along with it. Now, if we were to go over into the India area, looks like conditions there are going to be a lot drier. Only the coastal areas of India looking at some shower activity, although southern and central India could be getting into some showers next week.
Don, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Don Day is with Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. He joins us from his offices there. On this Tuesday edition of the Closing Mark Report, we'll say so long to some of our radio stations now. For the rest of you, stay with us. We'll be here with the Farming World.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333. Comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, we'll talk about next-generation renewable energy sources. John Ashworth is here to discuss the work of the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. The NRL is the nation's primary lab for renewable energy and energy efficiency research and development. The lab is located in Golden, Colorado. Mr. Ashworth, thank you for being with us today.
It's a pleasure.
Can you tell me a bit about the lab and its background?
We were created in 1977. The laboratory originally started out as the Solar Energy Research Institute, so obviously it was initially working on primarily on solar energy, but it quickly diversified off into a whole full range of renewable energy technologies. We're about 1,700 people. Biomass conversion, which is the area where I work, is the second largest part of the laboratory. We still have a large research program in solar conversion. Biomass is the next largest area. It's got about 140 full-time researchers and postdocs working here. And we work on all the ways that you can convert biomass into fuel. So biochemical conversion, which is fermentation, primarily, thermochemical conversion, which is high temperature processes for taking material, making it into a gas, and then converting the gas or the liquid into a fuel. And then we've restarted our program on algae conversion. So we are working on how do you take algae and make it into a fuel that can be put into a car or into a tractor or things like that.
Is it a government agency?
We are funded by the Department of Energy. The Department of Energy, I am not an employee of the Department of Energy. We are run by Battelle Research and by the Midwest Research Institute, but the funding is primarily from the Department of Energy. We also do have funding from industrial partners, but 90 to 95% of the funding is from the federal government.
95% of the funding comes from the federal government, and who do you partner with?
Primarily, we partner with people we partner with universities. We also partner with companies who are looking to develop new technologies or to test new technologies before they go out into the marketplace. Part of our job is to reduce risk. Part of what we do is we're an applied laboratory, so we're not just doing kind of fundamental research on this is the nature of the universe. We're really looking to develop technologies and methodologies that can be applied to making fuels. So in our case, transportation fuels. And we work with companies. They have an idea. They've developed the technology to a certain point. We can help them scale up that technology, figure out what is working, what's not working, what needs to be changed, before they go out and try to raise money to, take it out into the marketplace.
I may have jumped ahead of myself. Do you do research on your own without partners as well? I may have jumped ahead.
No, that's fine. The answer is yes. We have a basic research program, and that research program primarily is focused on converting non-food biomass into fuels. So making cellulosic ethanol from corn stover, wheat straw, switchgrass, wood chips. We've probably been the leading center in the world in that area since the early 1980s. And we have a pilot plant here, two pilot plants, as a matter of fact, where you can scale up those technologies to, say, a ton a day of material coming in the door. And all the pieces that go along with that process, we can do.
So let's talk more about this type of research. This is second-generation biofuels, meaning that it's not looking, as you said, at the seed. And in this case, we're used in our part of the world of talking about ethanol produced from corn or the corn seed. But you're talking about taking the plant itself as opposed to the corn, harvesting
Correct.
The corn, using it for feed or other products, and then taking the plant, what you would call the stover, or the cellulosic part, and converting that into energy. It was something that quite some time ago we thought would be 5 years away and hasn't really come to fruition at this point. How close are we?
We're getting pretty close. Our best estimate, the way we try to calculate cost. Everything we do here is based on not on cost. And our best estimate is that if you started with corn stover today and you paid the farmer for the corn stover, so you're not getting it for free, and you built a 2,000-ton-a-day plant to convert that corn stover to ethanol, that ethanol would cost you about $2.40 per gallon today. Still too expensive unless the price of oil goes way back up. But we're thinking that within the next 2 years, we can get the price down to about $1.50 per gallon. And at that price, including the capital cost, including the operating cost, including a small profit margin for the operator of the factory, so at that cost, it would be cost competitive with oil at $70 a barrel. And since oil is currently $86 a barrel, life would be good. So we think within the next 2 years, the technology that's out there will start coming online. There will be several medium-sized plants that should be up and running by 2012 using some of the technology that was developed here but also developed, you know, by companies themselves. So, and we think once somebody demonstrates it, the investment capital will become, you know, readily available and people will start building factories. So we see this as a 2-3-4 year process before a lot of these come online. There are 23 cellulosic ethanol plants that are either in the design or construct phase. A number of these are small, so they're pilot, somebody trying to prove a process, a concept. Some of them are larger. There's several at 700 tons a day that have actually gone through the permitting process and are getting ready to start construction. Actually, one of them has started construction, the others will start this summer. So it's getting there. And then in addition to that, there are other technologies that are further out that are more third-generation technology, so people who are looking not to make ethanol, but to make something like jet fuel, or making diesel fuel, or making gasoline directly from biomass. So those are a little bit further out, but there's a lot of people raising a lot of money to build those facilities.
Now, one of the expertise that I read in our EL claims it brings to the table, and you talked a bit about it, was your modeling expertise, and mm-hmm. I think you call it techno-economics. Can you explain yes. something about that?
Yeah. One of the things we learned a long time ago is that it's not enough to say that a technology works. You have to understand how the economics bear out in a large-scale setting. So about 10 years ago, we took some standard industrial modeling software. It's used by companies like DuPont and Dow Chemical and people like that to do their process modeling when they build a factory. So this is standard industrial software. And what we did is we developed models for all the conversion processes that you use to start from, say, a piece of wood and go, or a piece of corn stover and go to ethanol, whether it's thermochemical or biochemical. And it looks at all the mass and heat energy that's being moved around inside the factory and tries to understand where it goes. So you can't cheat on this software. It doesn't let you. And then we attach real costs from real marketplaces. So we go out to vendors and say, if we bought a piece of a grinder from you, what would you charge us for a piece of grinder that's this big? And then we put that into the model. We run the factory for a year in the model, and then it says, okay, what does the fuel end up costing? you've bought the capital, you have to pay the bank off for the capital, you have to have operating costs, you buy the feedstock, you have to clean up the wastewater, all the things that are normal with operating a factory. And then we just use that and we back calculate the cost of the fuel. And what we do every time we do a research project here, before we do it, we run the model and we say, okay, if this research project increases the efficiency of the conversion from 80% to 85%, what does that do to the cost of ethanol? Does it get us to closer to our targets? If so, then we can do the research. If it doesn't get us closer, we don't do it. So the whole point is drive down the cost.
So your research is really applied and not the basic type of research that would need to be done to explore really the newest technologies or those that haven't been developed yet or haven't been thought of yet. Is that right?
Well, we do some of that basic research, and we do it in order to feed into the more applied. So the best example is enzymes. When you break down some material like switchgrass or wheat straw or stover, you have to break apart these long chains of material down into simple sugars so the organism can eat them. The way you do that is with enzymes. The issue is nobody really understood how enzymes work, the actual mechanics of how they do their job. It's an amazingly complex process, and it's a biological process developed over millions of years. So we actually have tools here at the laboratory which allow us to go down almost to the atomic level, but certainly to the molecular level, where we can watch how the enzymes are working, and then we can make recommendations to enzyme companies about how to improve their enzymes because we understand better the actual mechanics of how these proteins are working in real time. And by doing that, we've been able to help the enzyme companies greatly increase the efficiency of their enzymes, which has made them cheaper. So, you know, the goal is to make it cheaper, but some of the science that goes into this is extremely high-tech and advanced, but the goal is always the same. The goal is always to get the materials and the processes less expensive.
The enzymes are difficult because oftentimes what they end up producing is, well, deadly to the enzyme?
No, enzymes are difficult because they were developed by organisms, usually fungi or things like that, in order for them to, you know, to eat. So, you know, I always tell people, if you think of, you take a tree and it falls in the forest, and you come back 20 years later, the part of the tree is gone. And the reason that tree is gone is that naturally occurring organisms in the forest have the ability to break down wood and eat it. And you know, and what they do is they make enzymes. Well, they do that very slowly. So it takes 20 years for a tree to break down in the forest. We're trying to break down these materials in 2 days. So you need enzymes that go much faster than the traditional, you know, enzymes did in nature. And that's what enzyme companies do. They try to figure out how to speed up the enzymes, how to make the organisms produce more of them. And when they do produce them, they work better. And so what we try to do is support that. And it's just complex proteins, you know, and those proteins are naturally occurring, but now they might work 100 times faster than they did in the wild. So the idea is we can help that process along, and by doing so, the enzyme companies will scale up their technology, they'll make it, they'll make more of it, they'll make it cheaper, and so that enables people who want to build a factory to make a less expensive fuel.
This afternoon, we're talking with John Ashworth. He's with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. You're listening to The Farming World. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. More in a moment.
It's National Homebrew Day. It's also National Candied Orange Peel Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1494, Columbus landed at Jamaica and met Native Americans who used Jamaican pimento or allspice to season and smoke meat, usually pigs, the foundation upon which Jamaican jerk developed. In 1854, Asa Finch was appointed as New York State entomologist, the first such in the United States. He studied insects and their effects on agricultural crops. Finch helped define the role for the scientist in solving public problems such as crop damage caused by insects. His annual reports became standard reading for entomologists and agriculturalists. In 1874, Frank Conrad was born, an American electrical engineer. His interest in sound waves led to the establishment of the first commercial radio station. He coined the term broadcast for regularly scheduled programs. In 1942, wartime food rationing began in the U.S., and in 2003, the first cloned mule was born at the University of Idaho. Researchers cloned the mule named Idaho Gem using a cell from a mule fetus and an egg from a horse. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you. Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening to The Farming World from Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Tug Gleason. Today we're talking with John Ashworth. He's with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. Mr. Ashworth, when we left, you were discussing enzymes and risk involved in all the kinds of things that have to do with second-generation fuels. We haven't taken up really, I think, maybe what is the point of the NREL, which is to help companies avoid some of the financial risk that comes along with developing these types of products. How do you do that?
Well, let me give you an example. Maybe that would be helpful. If you want to build a large-scale cellulosic ethanol plant today, using today's technology, that plant will cost anywhere from $300 million to $500 million. Whereas a corn ethanol plant today costs a 50-million-gallon plant would cost $100 million. A 100-million-gallon plant would cost $200 million. So these plants would be more expensive initially because of the capital. Bankers and other people are not willing to invest that kind of money unless they know that the technology works and it works at scale. So what we do here is we work with companies as they're developing technology and we help them scale it up. So if somebody is developing a new approach, they might be operating it in their laboratory at, say, 10-liter scale, which is 2.5 gallons. Okay, that doesn't mean much to a banker. So we have the ability here to scale that technology up first to 100 liters. We have 100-liter fermenters here. We can look at them, make suggestions, help people out with their approach, make it more efficient. Then we can scale it up to, say, 1,000 liters. Again, we have that in-house. And then we can scale it up to 10,000 liters, which is 2,500 gallons. And at that point, you're beginning to run into the real issues that you run into when you run a factory. The mixing issues, the, you know, transporting the material from point A to point B, moving it around. And so at that scale, you are really beginning to get data that's important. Because when you get to that scale, then you can take that money to an investor and say, see, the technology works. We're getting 75 gallons per ton of raw material. We've tried out different raw materials. The process works on different raw materials. NREL scientists have validated these numbers. They can tell you these are real. And then we can calculate out our best guess of what the cost of the production is. We're not going to get it perfectly right. But so that's how we help. We're really good at the engineering part of understanding how to do this. Sometimes you're working with companies that are very good at the biology part. They understand how a microorganism works, or they have a very good enzyme. Or you're dealing with the people who develop the feedstock. So, for example, there's a number of people right now who are developing new crops out there designed specifically for making fuels. So we recently had a large, very successful project with the National Sorghum Producers where they were looking at different varieties of sorghum and trying to understand if they would be easily converted into ethanol. Not grain sorghum, necessarily, but other kinds of sorghum, like forage sorghum, sweet sorghum. So we brought these things into our facility here. We tested them. We fermented them at small scales. We ran them through our pretreatment reactors. And then we ran a one-ton-a-day run of one of the more promising materials, and we calculated out the yields and the costs, and this is a really good feedstock. So, you know, we basically now enable people who are interested in developing one of these plants to have an additional feedstock that they hadn't thought about before. So this would be like forage sorghum.
So
go ahead.
So what you do in general is you provide the risk capital for the development of the technology, but not the development, not the capital to put up a plant. Is that correct?
Well, we develop the risk expertise rather than the capital. Sometimes the Department of Energy pays for some of these studies. Sometimes the company themselves pays for these studies. But what we're really good at is doing the work. We've done this for 20 years. We know how to do it. So somebody can come in here and very quickly understand what is right and wrong with their process, where areas they have to improve. In some cases, we can develop that process for them, or we can work with their scientists or their engineers to develop that. So we're really more trying to help industry. There's a famous expression called the valley of death in technology, and it means that you get the technology to a certain stage, and then you don't know what to do from there, and you run out of money, and you disappear. What we're trying to do is help companies across that valley of death so they can get to the point where they can prove their technology at a large enough scale that they can get funding to build a commercial plant.
Mr. Ashworth, thank you so much for your time today. We do appreciate you talking about the National Renewable Energy Laboratory with us.
My pleasure.
John Ashworth is a team leader for NREL's Bioenergy Center. He joined us from his Golden, Colorado office. You've been listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.